today, escalating tensions in the Middle East after the US assassination of Iran's most powerful general. And the Golden Globes get political. In the early hours of Friday morning, a US airstrike at Baghdad airport targeted and killed an Iranian general, Qassem Soleimani.
Well, thank you very much and good afternoon. As president, my highest and most solemn duty is the defense of our nation and its citizens. Last night, at my direction, the United States military successfully executed a flawless precision strike that killed the number one terrorist anywhere in the world, Qassem Soleimani.
I think there's no doubt that this is the biggest US scalp since Osama bin Laden in May 2011, but it is far more strategically significant than bin Laden's killing. Qassem Soleimani was the most powerful person in the Middle East. His influence strode the continent. He had shaped affairs in Syria. He had shaped the war in Iraq. He was extremely influential in Lebanon, and his tentacles extended to Yemen and to Bahrain. There's no question that he was the most influential person in the region, and to assassinate him is a defining moment.
A defining moment that has already led to threats and recriminations, with troops on notice to mobilise and US allies urging restraint. In the 4 days since the assassination, Iran has vowed to take revenge with chants of death to America in the country's parliament. Donald Trump tweeted that if Iran strikes any American or American asset, then a list of 52 Iranian targets, including important cultural sites, will be hit very fast and very hard. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in focus, the assassination of Qassem Soleimani and what comes next.
What we do know that at around 2 a.m., a plane from Damascus landed in Baghdad. And on that plane was Qassem Soleimani, the Iranian general.
Martin Chulov is The Guardian's Middle East correspondent.
They were met at the bottom of the plane by a welcoming party. They got into two cars, a Hyundai and a Toyota, and they were taken to the VIP lounge, which was befitting of their status, stayed a short time, drunk some tea, and set off in towards central Baghdad. They hadn't got more than 1,500 metres along the road out of the airport when they were attacked by an American drone, which fired multiple missiles through the roofs of both cars, killing all of those inside, including Soleimani.
What do we know about where Qassem Soleimani came from?
He came from a poor family in a city called Rabor in eastern Iran. He wasn't educated. He left school at the age of 13, and he was forced to work to pay his father's debts to the government of the Shah at the time. And by the time the monarchy fell in 1979, he became very committed to the clerical rule of Ayatollah Khomeini.
It's not exactly clear what an Islamic Republic would mean for Iran and her relations with the West. Many here see it in simple terms as a return to traditional justice and strict morality. What Khomeini most frequently condemns is foreign influence.
And he joined the Revolutionary Guards, which is the most significant arm of the Iranian military. He played a significant role in the Iran-Iraq War as a young officer. He saw a lot of combat. He commanded small units at the time. He was a junior officer then. But he earned his status on the battlefield. And by the end of the war, he'd become known as somebody who was committed to the goals of the Islamic Revolution and who was prepared to devote his life to a cause of messianic zeal.
So from being a child, he was instilled with this revolutionary spirit, this commitment to the new Iranian Islamic government, ever since his father got on the wrong side of the previous leader who'd been more secular. How did that zeal show itself?
The goals of the Islamic Revolution in 1979 were to export their values, particularly into the Sunni Arab world, into the neighbouring states. There were organisations formed within the structure of the Iranian government to advance those goals, and the Quds Force of the Revolutionary Guards was the main vehicle. Now, Qasem Soleimani won the trust of the clerics, and he was given the task to lead the Quds Force in 1998, and he held that position for 21 years until his death. And his job was to find strategic avenues for Iran to project its influence, particularly into Iraq and into Syria, and with the Hezbollah in Lebanon remaining the most important arm of Iran's foreign policy projection. So the overarching goal was to somehow form a direct line from Tehran to the borders of Israel, and that's certainly what he'd been working on in the last 5 to 10 years in particular.
Do we know whether he had a taste for conflict? I mean, had he become ruthless?
Some of those who observed Soleimani over the years did suggest that he had become conditioned to blood, somebody who saw reverting to violence very quickly as an obvious solution to most problems. Others said that he was a softer, more gentle type who was capable of compassion and mercy. It's certainly not what those in Syria would say, where he was responsible for the for leading the fight back on behalf of the Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad against the civilian population that rose up against him. And those in Iraq who've dealt with him say that he was a particularly ruthless man when he needed to be. He was somebody who struck fear and loathing into many of those that he met.
And in justifying the assassination, Donald Trump said Soleimani was responsible for the deaths of millions. Most people aren't suggesting that scale, but does he have blood on his hands?
There's certainly a consensus that he has a lot of blood in his hands, that he has been central to all Iranian activities in the region for particularly the last 15 years, but going back as far as 20 years. He was respected as an enemy. He certainly wasn't seen as someone who was deluded or crazy, but he was seen as somebody who was irreconcilable, ruthless, and who changed the course of the region.
Okay, not crazy, but do we know what he was like to deal with?
He certainly wasn't a man who ranted and raved. He had a quiet, steely presence to him, didn't speak a lot in meetings, didn't need to because he brought such power and aegis with him. He wasn't a big man in stature, but if he didn't like you or like what was going on, there would be silence.
You've described a person with huge power across the Middle East, projecting Iranian interests across the region, with direct influence over neighbouring governments. But it was after the invasion of Iraq in 2003 that we really saw him become an enemy of the United States.
There's no question that Qasem Soleimani and his proxies in Iraq, not so much the Quds Force directly, but Shia militias who had risen up in his name, were responsible for roughly a quarter of US battle casualties. They had developed by 2007 some very advanced weapons which were put at the side of the road.
Get up! Get up! Get up!
And were able to penetrate the armour of the most sophisticated US vehicles, and they did a lot of damage to US convoys that were driving past for the next 2 or 3 years.
News out of Iraq, where there are reports of a mortar round being fired close to the high security green zone in Baghdad.
Rocket attacks on the green zone in Baghdad were also a hallmark of what the proxies under Soleimani's name did, and they would claim that as a result of their attritional warfare, that they were able to chase the Americans out of Iraq in 2011, having achieved very little and having spent a lot of money to achieve very little.
So, today, I can report that, as promised, the rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year. After nearly 9 years, America's war in Iraq will be over.
And those tensions heightened when Soleimani played a critical role in Syria. Leading military figures in the US have credited him almost single-handedly with propping up Assad. But President Obama was said to consider him untouchable.
There was an instruction given by Barack Obama not to touch Qasem Soleimani, and that was widely known through the US security establishment from, say, 2013 through to 2016.
Why?
At that time, Obama was negotiating the nuclear deal, and he believed that he could co-opt Iran into acting as a force for good in the region.
Time and again, I have made clear to the Iranian people that we will always be open to engagement on the basis of mutual interests and mutual respect. Our differences are real, and the difficult history between our nations cannot be ignored. But it is possible to change. The path of violence and rigid ideology, a foreign policy based on threats to attack your neighbors or eradicate Israel, that's a dead end. A different path, one of tolerance and peaceful resolution of conflict, leads to more integration into the global economy, more engagement with the international community.
And he thought that the nuclear deal may have led to Iran behaving more responsibly, as he put it, in Syria.
And that work by Obama that you're talking about, that work towards the nuclear deal that was signed in 2015, feels as if it did build a kind of fragile peace between Iran and the US. As well as that, the two countries had a common enemy during that period in Islamic State. How did that all break down once Donald Trump became president?
Donald Trump has been determined to strip back all of the signature achievements of Barack Obama. And the nuclear deal was the main one. It was Barack Obama's foreign policy legacy. On the other hand, there is also a significant part of the US policy establishment that resented the nuclear deal in the first place. They said it was naive and that Iran would never come on board as a friend or a partner of the Americans, and that lifting sanctions was only going to empower them and allow them to entrench their position in the region.
And it seems as if things got personal between Trump and Soleimani himself.
Well, about 18 months ago, at the time that Donald Trump was about to wind back this nuclear deal, Soleimani issued a public warning to Donald Trump. He said, and I quote, "Mr. Trump the gambler, I'm telling you, know that we are close to you in that place you don't think we are. You will start the war, but we will end it."
Right, and that has been followed by ongoing tensions. US sanctions hit the Iranian economy.
The International Monetary Fund says inflation in Iran could hit 40% this year, as US sanctions have already had an impact on the economy.
Then America said Iran was responsible for mines placed on oil tankers in the Strait of Hormuz.
Well, Iran did do it, and you know they did it because you saw the boat. I guess one of the mines didn't explode, and it's probably got essentially Iran written all over it.
And then for an attack on its ally Saudi Arabia when a site of its state-owned oil company was targeted.
US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says Iran is to blame for drone strikes on two Saudi oil facilities. The attacks have caused huge fires, one at the world's largest oil processing facility.
That triggered retaliation attacks in both directions. And then it really escalated at the end of the year. What happened?
We had an Iranian-led attack on a US base, which killed a US contractor. We then had the US strike back at Shia militia bases in Iraq, killing upwards of 15 people. And then on New Year's Day, we had the Iranian leadership lead a storming of the US embassy in Baghdad. A very heavily fortified facility in the Green Zone, which is a secure area in the center of the capital. They were able to storm the large steel doors at the front of the embassy and get inside and ransack the huts at the front and cause some damage to the consular buildings themselves. And these were scenes that invoked images of Tehran in 1979 and Benghazi in 2012. They were visceral for the Americans. They do not like to see their diplomatic missions overrun like that. It was humiliating, and it shamed the American leadership in many ways. And I think that is what set in motion the decision to authorize the assassination of Soleimani.
Breaking news. In a major escalation in tensions between the U.S. and Iran, the top Iranian general has been killed in an airstrike while leaving the Baghdad airport. Qasem Soleimani was one of the most powerful figures in the Middle East and had been the top military man in Iran for more than 20 years.
Do we know how Donald Trump made the decision to target Soleimani?
We understand that in recent weeks there had been a range of options put to Donald Trump. One of those options was to assassinate him. It was considered by officials to be a low chance that he would take that. There's a smorgasbord usually put to presidents in situations like this, and nobody was expecting him to actually go for it. Initially, he didn't, we understand, but certainly by late last week, he'd changed his mind, sending officials in the White House and in the Pentagon into a scramble in order to first of all find Soleimani, then successfully carry out the targeting.
And did that shock officials?
It certainly shocked large parts of his administration, senior generals who were not expecting to be targeting an Iranian counterpart in such a short time. But it would have been less of a surprise to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and the Vice President Mike Pence, both of whom have been Iran hawks throughout their careers and certainly throughout the Trump administration. They had seen Qasem Soleimani as the bogeyman, the sum of all fears, and somebody who projected an existential threat to Israel.
So might they have been the reason that this extreme option was there in the first place? I mean, if officials don't think the president should do something like this, why do they provide it as an option?
Yeah, I think there are certainly conflicting views within the administration. There is a very well-known and entrenched Iran hawk group, which is led by Pompeo and Pence. So I think that option certainly would have been put there because it would have appealed to at least part of their thinking.
Boris Johnson has returned from holiday saying he doesn't lament Soleimani's death, but urging de-escalation along with European leaders. Others say Trump has thrown a stick of dynamite into a tinderbox. Do the people you're speaking to think that this makes the world a more dangerous place?
Certainly the consensus among people I am speaking to is that this does change things, that there is no way to look at things as they are today and say that the region is a safer place, that US interests have been advanced, or that that Iran is any less of a threat to US allies than it was last week. In fact, it seems as though Iran is on a more aggressive footing than it has been for many, many years, that it will pursue vengeance, that the US is at risk of being alienated from its allies in Europe. Boris Johnson is in an unusual position here in that his foreign policy fortunes are largely tied to the US. He can't be seen to condone this operation, nor can he condemn it. So he has to walk a middle ground here. He's between the devil and the deep blue sea, as are the Europeans.
This happened at 2 a.m. on Friday morning. It's now been a few days. What's happened since?
Well, the visceral scenes of the funeral processions right throughout Iran have been so striking. We've had millions of people on the streets of Iran. This death has galvanized Iranians behind their regime, and I think it has splintered any hopes of an anti-regime uprising that was certainly gathering steam in the weeks and months prior. This has been a nation-building moment for Iran. We've seen Qasem Soleimani's daughter take to state TV and say that the US faces a dark day for the killing. And in quotes, she said, "Crazy Trump, don't think that everything is over with my father's martyrdom. US soldiers' families will spend their days waiting for the death of their children." In addition to that, we've had Donald Trump threatening to go after Iranian cultural sites, to target them militarily, and that would be a war crime. We've had the Iranian parliament on its feet chanting "Death to America." across the border in Iraq, we've seen perhaps a more tangible outcome, certainly within 48 hours of this assassination taking place, and that being that the Iraqi parliament has passed a resolution which urges the ousting of US forces from Iraq within 12 months. That would be a death knell to the mop-up operation against the Islamic State, which has been jointly fought between Iraq and the US on Iraqi and Syrian soil. If the Iraqi parliament are voting for the ousting of the US and instead lamenting and mourning the death of Qasem Soleimani, a man who ruled over Iraq almost like some kind of a Persian viceroy for so many years. The relationship had been complex there, but it is if they are now being forced into a choice, it could well be that the choice that the Iraqis make is to ally themselves with Iran rather than the US. And this is all within 48 hours of this death taking place. So I think coming days and weeks are going to see some profound consequences, which really will change the way things are conducted in the Middle East.
How have the US felt about the reaction, and how have they felt about the reaction in particular of their allies, including Britain?
Well, the US have certainly been reaching out for allies and looking for public support. Secretary of State Pompeo has been saying that the Europeans in particular have not been helpful.
I spent the last day and a half, 2 days, talking to partners in the region, sharing with them what we were doing, why we were doing it, seeking their assistance. They've all been fantastic. And then talking to our partners in other places that haven't been quite as good. Frankly, the Europeans haven't been as helpful as I wish that they could be. The Brits, the French, the Germans all need to understand that what we did, what the Americans did, saved lives in Europe as well.
Europe is striking a position calling for a de-escalation of violence and no Iranian response here. They are desperate to protect what remains of the nuclear deal, which is something that the Americans see as being separate from their position. They are looking for robust support. They haven't been getting that. And they're unsettled at the different stance that the Europeans are taking.
It's very clear from everything that you've said that Iran wants revenge. But also, you've described how important Soleimani was to Iran. He was a masterful tactician who built up extraordinary influence for the country across the Middle East, who was critical to expanding his country's interest. Does the fact that he's gone hamper Iranian efforts? Does it make it much more difficult for them to achieve revenge?
The organization that Soleimani ran for the past 20 years, the Quds Force of the Revolutionary Guards, are the most elite in the country. They're ideologically driven, they're mission focused, they have people right throughout the region, and they were very, very loyal to the cause. So I think with him being gone is a serious blow to Iran, no question about that. He had the momentum and he certainly had the trust of the leadership. So him being out of the way will slow down their capacity to press ahead with his agenda, but it won't cripple it. People will step up. He has had very loyal deputies who have been able to prosecute various operations around the region, and they will be able to pick up the slack.
And with both sides determined to retaliate, but neither seemingly wanting a war, how do you see this playing out?
Well, already we're seeing the bare bones of an Iranian strategy. It was laid out over the weekend by the leader of Hezbollah, which is the main proxy of Qasem Soleimani in Lebanon. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah said that what would be a target that they would settle for would be the removal of US forces from Iraqi soil. Now, no sooner had he said that than the former Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdelmahdi was in the parliament calling for exactly that. There was a resolution passed in urging the expulsion of US forces within the next 12 months. If that were to happen, it would be a fulfillment of what Qasem Soleimani had been aiming for the last 15 years of his life. It would be something that the Iranians could cling to as a moral victory and something which could justify his martyrdom. So that would certainly be the bare bones of a strategy, and it would allay fears of a broader regional war. That said, though, there does need to be some kind of a bloodletting in Iranian eyes to settle scores here. The ledger needs to be squared, and therein lies the danger. There will be an attempt to go after US interests militarily, whether that be in Europe, whether that be in Afghanistan or elsewhere. Will Iran overcalculate and will the Americans overreact?
Martin, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Martin Chulove. Do follow all his reporting on this story as it develops at theguardian.com. Coming up, the Golden Globes get political like never before. Now, this year's Golden Globes were a great night for British film and TV, with Sam Mendes' 1917, Olivia Colman and Phoebe Waller-Bridge all bagging awards. For Netflix, the night wasn't so good, taking home only 2 out of a total of 34 nominations. But for The Guardian's film editor Catherine Shord, this year's awards were less about the winners and more about the politics.
The Golden Globes happened in Los Angeles on Sunday night. There were loads of shocks and surprises amongst the award winners. But the big story, really, was the host Ricky Gervais telling the stars to avoid politics completely in their speeches.
If you do win an award tonight, don't use it as a platform to make a political speech, right? You're in no position to lecture the public about anything. You know nothing about the real world. Most of you spent less time in school than Greta Thunberg. So, if you win, right, come up, accept your little award, thank your agent and your God, and f*** off, OK?
Very few of them played ball. Most of them used the stage as a platform in which to campaign about variously abortion rights, in the case of Michelle Williams, who gave a very passionate speech.
And I'm also grateful to have lived at a moment in our society where choice exists, because as women and as girls, things can happen to our bodies that are not our choice.
Democratic inclusivity. Patricia Arquette gave the incredible speech near the end, urging people to vote for the sake of their children.
So while I love my kids so much, I beg of us all to give them a better world.
Sacha Baron Cohen did an amazing piece about comparing Mark Zuckerberg to a Nazi, which was attacking Facebook's ad-checking policies.
The hero of this next movie is a naive, misguided child who spreads Nazi propaganda and only has imaginary friends. His name is Mark Zuckerberg.
But I suppose the big topic of the night really was climate change. So you had Russell Crowe via Jennifer Aniston, who read out his speech, talking about the fires in Australia and how they were very definitely caused by climate change.
Make no mistake, the tragedy unfolding in Australia is climate change based. We need to act based on science, move our global workforce to renewable energy, and respect our planet for the unique and amazing place it is. That way, we all have a future. Thank you.
Nicole Kidman also weighed in on that, and Joaquin Phoenix in his speech. He didn't directly allude to them, I don't think, but he did speak about how you don't really need to take a private jet to Palm Springs. It was back in 2015 that Patricia Arquette used her Oscars acceptance speech to campaign for greater wage equality in Hollywood. At the time, this was seen as an extraordinarily radical thing to do, using a showbiz speech to campaign for politics.
It's our time to have wage equality once and for all, and equal rights for women in the United States of America.
Now it's absolutely old hat, and what's really changed is that actors and actresses are no longer just talking about the problems in-house in Hollywood, the industry problems of wage equality, of diversity, of representation, of sexual harassment even. And now they're really looking at the outside world and the problems that all of us are experiencing. And that's a really good move for everybody. Nobody can ignore the fact that the world is on fire. And they're really, that's what they're focusing on now. They're not talking about their own problems. Hollywood can't avoid the headlines anymore. On Monday, Harvey Weinstein's trial started in New York with Patricia Arquette and many others in attendance. Gervais's advice to the stars in their speeches to avoid politics was advice born from a different era. Let's hope that their ignoring of it is a sign of things to come.
That was Catherine Shord. Do read her comment piece on this on the website. That's it for today. If you're enjoying Today in Focus, then do subscribe, and if you get a chance, leave us a review. My thanks to Martin Chulov and Catherine Shord. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly, Courtney Youssef and Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.